So last week, we talked about the powerful energy of sensual desire and sexual desire. We talked about sex a little bit. And in a way, with that as sort of part one, I want to sort of look at another side of it today that shows up in... I was talking with a student the other day. We were looking at a particular early Buddhist text that laid out a model of how the Buddha understood or taught about qualities of intense desire or wanting, and particularly the desire for contact, pleasurable contact with objects of the senses, and for feelings, and it's a teaching called, it doesn't get taught on a lot in the West, partly because it's a renunciate teaching. It's called the gratification, the danger, and the escape. The gratification, the danger, and the escape. And it hinges on this this basic sense that that I've brought in the last few times. So those of you that have been here a bunch will be getting used to this model, which is a model of perception that says, here's what's happening moment to moment. There's a kind of base consciousness, so like there's an awareness process happening. And through the physical sense organs, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the body as physical sensing, and then the mind heart, as an internal kind of sense organ, that through these senses, there is contact. And there's contact with things. And over in the sort of Western sort of phenomenology world, we would call them percepts, like little momentary flashes of perception content, right? So like, you know, I look over there and I see a kind of gray rectangle surrounded by a brownish field. So I get a sort of color, shape, line, boundary, percept, really a whole collection of percepts. And a set of things happens almost simultaneously. And the Buddha describes them in a series of steps, but says that all of these things happen essentially at the same time, or so fast that you can't really tell the difference, which is that there's contact, like I see that thing. There's a kind of recognition of it. There's the perception process where when I see it, without having to do anything particularly, there's an understanding, you know, window, wall, rectangle, color. Like I could name a bunch of things about it without even thinking about it, right? Tissue box. It just is known in its identity. And again, that's not an absolute reality, right? We can say that that's conditioned, right? Even the fact that I could call it window and not fenêtre, right, means I'm from a certain place. And it's a different... It's a different everything, actually, right? Because a fenêtre is a different thing than a window, even though fenêtre is the French translation of window, right? So, and depending on my conditioning, there could be other percepts as well, right? I could have a certain kind of, say, trauma where part of me registers, you know, escape route in case of fire. Huh? You know, I could see that when I see window. It could be embedded in window. So the perceptions are learned. They're based on our past. They're not absolute. Nothing in that thing contains those meanings. But the through the organ of the eye, there's a connection with it, and these perceptions happen immediately. The Buddha says also, essentially immediately, there comes what I mostly call a valence, or charge, in a way, of the sense object being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, or something like neutral. Mostly things are slightly pleasant or slightly unpleasant. Every once in a while something is more strongly at either end of that spectrum. And every once in a while something seems, or actually quite often things seem neutral, and only if we really hang out with them for a while do we sense which side they slightly tip on, right? Like the window is mostly neutral to me, But if I really let my attention rest on it and feel it, there's a very slight unpleasantness. I don't completely love the frosted glass thing. So there's a way that I want to see through it and I can't. And that's very slightly unpleasant. And I can perceive that, right? And the teaching on this sequence is that it's essentially autonomic. We don't choose what is pleasant and unpleasant to us. Again, that's part of conditioning, right? If I, as a child, had been thrown through a plate glass window, it might be strongly unpleasant. If I, as a child, had grown up with plate glass windows and big forests on the other side and a feeling of security and beauty, it could be strongly pleasant. Again, the pleasantness and unpleasantness is not in the thing, but in the conditioned relationship. But the experience of pleasant, unpleasant happens basically automatically and right away. Based in that, then, there's a next step. And the next step is the important part for the Buddha and for liberation. The next step is that based on a perception, a sense contact through any of the sense doors, being pleasant or unpleasant, I have a habit, and again, this habit is conditioned, to like it or dislike it. Generally, I like the pleasant and dislike the unpleasant. In fact, universally, I like the pleasant, and that's the definition of pleasant and unpleasant, is that I like it and or dislike it. And based in liking and disliking, I have a habit to want more of the pleasant and to want less of the unpleasant. And that wanting is called grasping. The Pali word for it is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, which literally means thirst. So I encounter the world, all of these perceptions and kind of charge is apparent to me instantly. And I might notice that or not, right? I could not have mindfulness and it happens anyway, right? I don't have to know that, I don't have to think, I'm aware of window, for my brain to just go, window, don't like it, you know, or whatever. That just happens, whether I'm distracted or not. The next step, wanting more of the pleasant and less of the unpleasant, is one of two things. It's either unconscious, like it's also habitual, or we notice it, or it becomes conscious, right? We notice it. And that moment of noticing the wanting something to be more of the pleasant or wanting less of the unpleasant is the hinge in this teaching. This is basically, this is the teaching of dependent origination, is the sort of formal name for this model. The hinge wherein I have a choice. This is the spot where I can train myself to not just go along the slide of habit. If I go along the slide of habit, I perceive something as slightly unpleasant, I dislike it, I want less of it, and that wanting less of it calcifies essentially into an identity. Yeah, right? And I could name that identity as like, I'm the kind of person who doesn't like frosted glass. Right? Right? To take this relatively meaningless example. But, you know, for it to be much more meaningful, it could be, for instance, a person who looks like something that I'm afraid of. And again, that's conditioned, but it's not chosen. And the wanting more of the pleasant and less of the unpleasant is going to be at the basis, right, of all of those habitual or unconscious reactions, reactivities to things that create our world. They create identity, they create separation, they create distinction. And they create, most prominently in the Buddhist system, suffering. Right? No matter which side they are, if I see the window and I like it and I really appreciate it, oh, what a nice room because it has the kind of window that I like. Right? I'm appreciating the architecture, I'm in favor of the room. Why would that create suffering? Right? I'm getting what I want. Oh, I'm privileged. I get to be in nice spaces that are pleasurable to me. Right? It creates suffering partly, and privilege is a good way to talk about it, because I am attached to it. Well, I want to maintain that privilege, don't I? I want to stay in rooms with nice windows. And I don't want to be subject to rooms with unnice windows. So then, privilege or the privilege of continued contact with the pleasure that you like amplifies itself through the desire to maintain itself, Right? And again, this is generally unconscious. No one wants to give up the things they like. Right? We'll get to that. So suffering comes when I grasp onto the pleasant, partly because it's contractive to grasp at all, and partly because to maintain my contact with it, I'm going to have to perpetuate a whole system of things that are basically painful. And in this example of this one teaching, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, one of the examples that the Buddha gives for why contact with the pleasurable is suffering is not immediately that it's impermanent. That is a reason why it's suffering, like, you know, oh, well, the plate glass window eventually will be taken from me through breakage or civil war or, you know, the death of rent control. You know, whatever it is, I will lose the good building. But that's not the example that the Buddha initially gives in this one text. He gives that elsewhere. He gives an example that says, it's like this. If there's a craftsman who's good at a certain craft, whether that craft is, and he lists a bunch of crafts, which is really interesting, whether that craft is accounting, finances, pottery, archery, whatever it is. He lists a series of interestingly sort of upper middle class tasks. Pottery is actually not in the list. I was like, what is any of that? But it's not. It's actually a whole series of like business and military and kind of management tasks. But he says one could have these tasks, and while one is doing these tasks in order to maintain one's contact with the pleasurable, one is still beset by gadflies, mosquitoes, ants, scorpions, crawling things. One is beset by strong sun, wind, rain, cold, heat, sickness, and death. In other words, you work so hard to maintain your pleasures, that also is a suffering, right? So if you want to maintain contact with the pleasurable, you have to work for it, and that's hard. And you can't avoid the vicissitudes of human life. Bugs, temperature, we could say climate change, plagues, structural inequality, right? So built into our response to things is the suffering that's inherent if they're pleasant, and of course the suffering that's inherent if they're unpleasant, right? Part of that is the direct unpleasantness itself, like it's not pleasant to encounter a window that architecturally I don't prefer. But it's also unpleasant to be out of control about its existence, right? I'm not in charge here. I don't get to say, you know, let there be a better window, people. You know, like, I'm not that privileged, which is fine, you know. But there's a suffering in not being able to prevent unpleasantness. And this goes back to the very basic teaching of the remind yourself every day. This is the list of things to remind yourself of every day. I am subject to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. I am subject to sickness. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am subject to death. I have not gone beyond death. The teaching is, every day, remind yourself that old age, sickness, and death are inevitable. And the moment is unknown. So, the moment of old age is somewhat known. But not really. Like, you could get old quickly, depending on conditions. And certainly the moment of sickness and the moment of death are unknown. So we're told to remind ourselves of this over and over. And it abstracts out to all unpleasant contacts. Right, you can't protect yourself from the unpleasant. That would be an unreliable refuge. So then what is our choice here? And our choice is the escape part. So the teaching, the gratification, the danger, and the escape goes like this. The gratification is simply the thing you like in it. Right? I see the beautiful thing and I like it. Right? I see the pretty person that I'm attracted to. And there's a ping of liking. Oh, it's just pleasurable to see pretty people of whatever flavor pretty person you like. Or pretty art, or pretty sensory perceptions of any kind. Provocative of desire and lust. There's a pleasure in that. That's the gratification. The danger is what we just looked at, right? That if you like it, there's a danger in that. And for the things that you dislike, there's a danger in that. The escape very simply, and this is why it's a renunciate teaching, that the escape is simply to stop wanting it. I know, right? You're like, thanks a lot. But the text phrases it like this. The escape is the stopping, cessation, letting go, relinquishing, and renunciation of that very desire and lust. Basically, just stop. And that's a good reflection, because this is very much an addiction model, right? It's basically saying we're drawn habitually by a force we can't really control again and again to a certain kind of sensory contact. And of course, an addiction, all we mean by an addiction is that we've hooked onto a certain object that reliably gives us, or unreliably, so we need more and more of it, pretends to be reliably giving us a pleasurable experience. And we have to seek it out again and again and again. I become fixated on clean plate glass windows. Must have them. I seek out every building in town, and I just stand there and I look through them, right? And then people are like, stop looking through my window. And I'm like, fine. I lurk down the block, and I find another one, that's a plate glass window, right? I'm addicted to plate glass windows. There's a gratification, there's a danger, and the escape is stop doing it. So there's two ways to do this, right? The first is the classic renunciate way, which is don't look. Right, that's the simple way. This is the way that when the teaching would be spun as a way to deal with essentially teenage lustfulness in boys, and this is a teaching for young monks, right? The teaching is don't look at the girls. Mm-hmm. Or we could abstract it, of course, into a poly-systemic attraction model and say don't look at whatever kind of person gives you that burst of pleasure and lust. And this is a teaching very classical in the yoga traditions, right? In Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, this is the fifth limb called pratyahara, the withdrawal of the senses. And it essentially says, if there's a pretty person across from you, close your eyes, right? Like, just don't do it. And we don't like this teaching because we're in a hedonistic, a very greedy culture. And we also are really into relationship. It's not a monastic culture. It's not a renunciate culture. So this is an unpopular teaching. But of course, it works to an extent. But it's only really a cork. And the deeper turning of that actually is to confront the habitual grasp itself. And for that, you actually have to do the opposite, in a sense, which is you have to see it, and you have to do a difficult thing, which is you have to pull the wanting up out of the realm of the autonomic, and you have to make it conscious. You have to be aware, oh, I'm liking what I'm seeing, and I'm grasping onto that. And I have to stay there and backtrack and be like, what happens if I just relax? Because grasping essentially is a contraction, right? I kind of hook onto something. What happens if I see the attractive thing and I just soften in relation to it, right? And this would be radical, dangerous addiction therapy if it was like a substance, right? Because the teaching would essentially, this would be a very tantric addiction therapy, would be like, pour the drink and look at it and just feel the wanting like burn through you and stay with that until it crests and settles. And then pick the drink up and smell it and feel the wanting rise up again as a wave in you. And you might have to do this like in the company of really powerful support, right? This is partly why renunciate practices are almost never solo practices. You're with a group of people, right? You're a monk among monks. You're a nun among nuns. Renunciation is not an act of will pushing the thing away, right? It's not renunciation of drink to say, you know, I absolutely reject the drink. Renunciation more deeply, and maybe renunciation isn't even the best translation. It's a Western translation, and we think of it with a kind of sin-based, like, I'm going to resist this thing quality to it. But it's a translation generally of the term vairagya. And it literally means, like, without hook or without wanting. It's just without the wanting. And the teaching would essentially be like, if we're, let's use drink as the example. I'm looking at a shot glass of whiskey, right? That like good scotch, it glimmers in the light. And I just learned that scotch is something like 10% of the Scottish national economy, and most of it goes to the single market of Europe, and the Scots want to maintain contact to the single market. Whiskey, EU, right? And I'm thinking about like the further dissolving of the British Empire, partly because of Scotch whiskey. You know, and I heard a very confident whiskey brewer say, you know, essentially, look, we're Scots. This is whiskey. This is Scotch whiskey. Nobody's going to stop buying Scotch whiskey. Like, we're fine. We're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, but he also said, and we want to maintain contact with the single market. That was totally an aside. that was the Brexit aside on this. I heard that Marine Le Pen is going to propose Frexit. If she gets into power. The far right in France also would love to do what the far right likes to do. So the solution would be, in a sense, like true renunciation is not the pushing away, which is a kind of willful aversion. And that's very hard to maintain. Will is hard to maintain. Will is a muscle in the psyche that actually has a fairly short life. Like, it wears out. And so that doesn't really work, actually, to conquer addiction, as anyone who's tried to conquer addiction through sheer will knows. That's the cold turkey method, right? The method, in a sense, for true renunciation is, like, to set it there and just see it and be in contact with it and really soften in relation to the liked or disliked object. And this is actually vairagya. It's the letting go of the habitual contraction itself. And the result of that, then, is not a kind of denial of pleasures, but it's a full understanding of pleasures. And this is the escape clause of the gratification, the danger, and the escape. Is when the danger in that which is gratifying is truly seen, right? Because, of course, the trap is that we don't see the danger in it. It's like, oh, pretty people, I like looking at them. There's no danger in that, right? It's like, oh, there's only no danger in it if I don't look at the effect of lust on my psyche, right? The effect of that little tiny contraction, even if I'm in a very wide open, hedonistic, you know, beauty-loving culture, as I am, actually. If I don't feel the danger in it, it's going to be very... There's going to be no motivation to escape from it, and this is... the perpetuating of the wheel of birth and death in the Buddhist system. This is why samsara continues, right? You get endlessly reborn, not because you're trapped here, but because you want to be. And the end of it is simply not wanting to be. So the escape is simply the letting go of the contraction around that which doesn't deserve grasping. It's the letting go of the grasping around that which doesn't deserve grasping. And it's important to note for a kind of almost feminist or humanistic non-denial or transcendence-oriented teaching to say that letting go of grasping, that which doesn't deserve grasping, is not the same as becoming aggressive toward or pushing away or even letting go of appreciating that which is beautiful. And I think it's a challenge for modern practitioners to engage with our processes in a subtle enough way that we remain present with the beautiful, but not grasping it. And there's a tremendous both liberation in that, which is what the Buddha was emphasizing, but there's also a tremendous change in the aesthetic of it. In other words, the beautiful, the plate glass window or the pretty person, actually in a certain way becomes more beautiful to me when I remove that little contraction in my spirit. Because that contraction is actually unpleasant, even though I think it's pleasant to grasp. It's actually slightly unpleasant because it almost kind of shrinks the world for a moment. And there's a kind of wanting that which I can't have. If I drop that, the only thing that I'm dropping is the unpleasant aspect of contact with the beautiful. And once I drop that, there's a freedom to be in the world more fully. And this is one of the things that's hard to explain in the context of a renunciate teaching, because it all sounds like we should be letting go of these things that we want. And the thing I've heard monastics say this, and other folks who really practiced very renunciate paths, is, and you have to take this a little bit on faith, the pleasure of equanimity, or the pleasure of the balanced heart that is not clinging, is actually so much greater than the pleasure of that spark of contact with the intensely pleasurable, that it's indescribably different. But it's so subtle that it's hard to notice. And it would be a little bit like telling a little kid that pure, good water tastes better than Mountain Dew. And it's like, no. It just doesn't. It's boring. And it takes a certain amount of maturity, that maturity primarily consisting in perceiving the unpleasantness of the Mountain Dew, right? Once you perceive that and you actually truly taste the pleasure in clear water, you will never go back. Like, you might have Mountain Dew for fun at some point, but you'll never unlearn what you now know about equanimity. And so this is one of the promises then in the teaching on contact with the sensual. And this is embedded in the teaching on sexuality that we talked about last week. What would it be like to disentangle from our sexuality the grasping that so habitually lives there from the, I'm not sure I love this word, but pure or maybe direct contact with what it actually is, sexual energy or sexual relationship with another, to separate those two. And we get very little support for this in our culture, right? The media is full of, like, you must grasp. And what would it be like, the teachings propose, to let go of the painful part, the contraction, and simply be in the direct contact with that which is one of the most beautiful things that we are given as human beings. So I'll pause there. And since we talked about being on time last week and the week before, I'm gonna once again do a new practice of trying to essentially restrain my Dharma talk-ness, my yakking on and on, to give us a good, like, kind of a full 20 minutes of discussion time and questions, and more precisely a quarter after, which I'm supposed to do. So that'll be my little discipline to attempt. And this is just now time to open the floor and hear from anyone. Reflections, what you're thinking about, please.
Are there things that you say there are things to which you should not grasp? Are there things you should grasp, or is that merely a?
There are, basically. We have to, at least as a temporary maneuver, grasp onto the wholesome as opposed to the unwholesome. And so there's, for instance, lists of good qualities, right? Mindfulness, investigation, joy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. So these are all qualities of mind. You know, the quality of loving kindness, the quality of compassion, right? The quality of joy. All of these are things to, we could say grasp onto. What that really means is orient toward cultivating them, right? And we do get attached.
Lean into,
but with some vigor, you know. Like the Buddha will say, you go like a state like mindfulness, right? Or basic awareness, right? Being awake to what's happening. The instruction will essentially be like, hook into this quality and maintain it really with all your skills in a constant way. And we could say that that means like grasp onto it, grasp onto mindfulness as a mental quality until it's embedded and becomes habitual. It's almost like, and here's a simile from the Buddha. He says, it's as if a carpenter removes a coarse peg by means of a finer one. So one should develop the wholesome qualities as a way to remove the unwholesome qualities. So you grasp onto mindfulness because it allows you to get rid of, you know, rage, anger, lust, doubt, fear, because you see them and they are released through the body. Mindfulness becomes habitual, and there's a point in the sequence of practice when even mindfulness falls away. Right? And at the very, very last moment before what's called cooling or utter cessation, nibbana or nirvana, the word nirvana means cooling, like a flame going out for lack of fuel. Where does the flame go? It doesn't go anywhere, right? It was dependent on the fuel. When the fuel is exhausted or it's separated from its fuel, it just goes out, right? So nirvana is the cooling of that grasping once it is separated from its fuel. And at the moment of that thing, which is called a cessation, right? Nirodha, cessation, even mindfulness is gone, right? But that's a moment at the very end, if we're going to go linear, of the path. Until then, there's things to grasp onto, right? And again, you basically use finer and finer pegs, right? Until, you know, it's like, and, you know, and the last thing falls, right? And of course, the very last thing to go is the very last, what's called fetter, to go before full enlightenment is the tiniest bit of comparison where you see yourself as different from another. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you've got hella meditative skills. Mm-hmm. And so that's the tiniest bit of comparison where super advanced meditators say, wow, I'm nearly enlightened, and I'm 1 inch closer to full enlightenment than Ben, even though he's extremely powerful, right? That tiny comparison, even if it's the other way around, even if I'm about to get enlightened and I'm like, wow, I'm almost nearly completely liberated, but Ben is already liberated, right? That little bit of self, that's the last thing. And the very final maneuver is to see that with mindfulness, which is still with me, and be like, oh, that's just grasping onto the self, right? And if you actually see that, or to use the millennials, sign language, right? The amazing Thai forest master, Ajahn Mun, from the early 20th century, described the moment of full liberation. Almost nobody describes this, partly because almost nobody gets there. But he says that he felt himself on the brink of it, and he wondered. He had a moment of doubt where he flashed into the Mahayana teaching of the Bodhisattvas and said, like, wait, should I pause before getting fully enlightened in order to remain in samsara to serve suffering beings? And he was like, no, that's not the point. The point is that the world needs liberated beings. And that he said, once he sort of saw that and accepted what was to be done, he said he then, in a sense, like, he both applied effort, but then applied no effort. And he said it was as if, he describes it in his autobiography, he said it was as if the sky broke apart and everything just fell apart. And then he just sobbed. He just started crying at how incredible it was. Which is an amazing description because it sounds so empty when you go like, oh, it's empty of the self and it's empty of emotions. And you've got this old monk who's been like, and this is the language of the Thai forest teachers, battling the defilements day in, day out for, you know, decades, you know, on retreat, sitting in caves, like, you know, staring down demons. And it finally breaks apart and he just cries at how stunning it is. So that last moment, nothing, right? But up until that moment, you still have all of your mindfulness and perseverance and faith and all of the good qualities. Those are the things to cling to.
It sounds like a disappointment with someone or something. When the way you're describing it, it's kind of like you're trying to get somewhere and then you get there and it's nothing.
If it was actually nothing, the way that we imagine nothing to be, it would be disappointing. But the descriptions used of it are that it's indescribably different from anything we can imagine, because we can only imagine things based on what we've seen. It's sort of like I've lived in the city my whole life, and I'm told what the Great Desert is. It's vast, it's open, you know, the prairies, like but I've never experienced it. And so I'm going to think, oh, that sounds really empty. There's no stores, there's no people, there's no nothing that I recognize. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine what that's like. Oh, it's going to feel relaxing, or it's going to feel divine, or it's going to feel scary. Or I could come up with ideas, mm-hmm. but those ideas are only going to be based on my imagination of something that's opposite of what I know. Mm-hmm. But none of them are actually going to be accurate to the feeling of being there. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the desert is not actually the opposite of the city. It's its own thing. And I wouldn't know that. I won't know that until I get there. And so nirvana sounds empty, void, boring, whatever. And it turns out to be none of that. Mm-hmm. But not in a way that they can tell us from where we're sitting. Right? Because I can only see what I can see. You know?
You said you needed a support network and saying things that you grasp at. Can you speak a little bit more to that, like what that would look like or why?
Yeah, you need a support network to help renouncing. In a way, we need a support network to help any kind of practice that goes against the stream of the kind of general culture. So even, you know, let's say you wanted to take on the renunciate practice of, you know, becoming vegan. Which is not generally supported in American culture. And so if you want to really do it, you have to get together with people who also do it. You know, you could sort of try, you know, and I've known folks to be like, I don't know, I was just, you know, I was in college, I was in Kansas City, there's no vegans around, but I just tried. I was like, I'm just going to do it. And I don't know, I just lived on, you know, donuts for a while or whatever it was. Like you can't do it until you hook into a support network. In the same way, if what we're talking about is shifting our relationship to, let's say, attraction to people, there's no support for that in the culture. Mm. You know, similarly, you know, in terms of like, if you want to come out as queer, right, depending on where you live, there's no support for that. And it's really hard, right? And I'm remembering this kind of amazing moment in the Harvey Milk movie. I cried like 20 times during that movie. But there's this moment where Harvey is, he gets a random phone call from a kid in like the Midwest, right? And the kid is like, I'm so lonely, I want to kill myself, nobody understands me, I can't do it. And Harvey's just like, and at first you see on his face, like he doesn't quite know what to say. Like the suffering is so intense. And then he just says, he says, it's going to be okay, get a bus ticket, and just get yourself to the city. Get to Chicago or New York or LA or San Francisco, and you will find the people who are like you. And it's going to be okay once you get there. Just get there. And it's a beautiful response in a way, because it doesn't go in and try to be like, be strong, just be who you are, you know, resist the culture. It just says, find your people, you know. And of course, it also means find safety, because the kid is also describing a situation that's literally unsafe for him, right? We can reframe the whole conversation around pleasure and pain as a nervous system response to safety and threat, right? We want more safety, we want less danger. And the whole connection with the pleasurable can be understood as very simply an animal response to danger and safety. Right? Safety is pleasurable intrinsically. Danger is unpainful intrinsically. And we have this very biological urge, of course, toward safety. Yeah?
I'd like to ask a question which I think echoes the last one.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more in detail about the process of taking some form of desire that is perhaps unconscious, it's habitual, has become habit.
Yeah.
Some gratification activity that's become habitual, and raising it to the level of consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing you have to do is find it, right? Like, how do you bring the unconscious into consciousness, right? And, you know, you can lie on the analyst's couch and just go through everything that comes out, and eventually you're going to stumble on something. And if the analyst is good, the analyst is essentially basically going to be like, that, you know? And what you've done is you've unearthed something that you weren't conscious of. You brought it into the light of consciousness. So, but like in a Buddhist context, I think one of the reasons there's all these lists of qualities, both painful and positive qualities, like the list of the hindrances, you know, sensual desire, aversion or hatred, restlessness, sleepiness, doubt. Doubt is a great one because doubt comes in the form of a story, a voice that shows up in me. And if it's unconscious, I just believe the story. I'm cruising along, I meet someone, and I'm like, oh my God, they're out of my league, you know, or I'll never get that job. Whatever it is, right? Self-doubt for many of us comes, you know, often, but you can project it outward. Oh, that teacher doesn't know what he's talking about, you know. Doubt is one of those things that is unconscious until it's conscious. And one of the mechanisms of having a list of unwholesome qualities is that you can just compare your ongoing experience to the list. Am I experiencing any of the five hindrances right now? Oh, there's doubt. And so the list actually points to things that are probably unconscious that you could bring into consciousness. So that's one way. So you can go exploring on your own through dreams, through intuition, through ritual, right? You can put yourself in intense situations. This would be the tantric method. Put yourself in an intense situation, like an intense symbolic ritual, and then see what happens. Oh, I was doing this chant, visualized, suddenly I was afraid, right? And you kind of unearth it by doing something intense, right? Or you do it the dancer method, right? You just shake your entire body, trying to get every part of the body shaking for a full hour with intense music. And then you stand in silence or lie down, and you feel whatever's there. Right? So you can do this. You unearth it by yourself, or you compare your experience to a map, like one of the lists. Those are ways to do that initial revealing. Once it's revealed, then you have a practice, right? Like you've got to take on practicing with doubt. And you could say, okay, now whenever I hear any of a set of kinds of phrases in my mind, you know, I can't, I won't be able to, I'm not good enough, they can't, they won't be able to, you know. You can learn them, and you can say, oh, that's doubt. You give it a name, Rumpelstiltskin, whatever. And then every time, then you train yourself that every time that thing shows up, you name it. Even if you think it's true, right? Because it's not about whether the doubt story is true or not, right? You might not get the job. But the voice that says, I won't get the job, is doubt, right? So then you learn to label a pattern of things, and you label them again and again and again until they've become kind of fully unearthed. And every time that voice even peeks its head around, you say, I see you. And this is a classic phrase in the Buddhist texts. There's a kind of semi-divine figure called Mara, who's descended from the proto-Hindu or Vedic god of death. Who in the Buddhist text is just like a trickster figure. And he comes up, it's kind of usually depicted as a he, comes up to throw the Buddha off his path, and shows up even after the Buddha is enlightened. And he's the personification of doubt, essentially. And so there's a story that says the Buddha, as he was getting older, had a bad back. One day, his back was hurting. He asked his assistant, Ananda, please give the talk, Ananda. I'm going to go and rest. He goes into his cabin. He lays down on his right side in the royal pose with his left foot on top of his right, with his head on his hands, and closes his eyes to enter a period of mindful rest. And the demon Mara appears in the doorway saying, aha, the Blessed One is resting. Oh, are we sleepy in the middle of the day, wakeful one? Are we afraid of pain in the back, O equanimous one? Right? Mara shows up as self-doubt to say, should I be resting right now? And the Buddha's response, every time Mara shows up, is to say, I see you, Mara. Just names him, I see you. And Mara says, inevitably, oh, the Blessed One has seen me. And Mara slinks away, which is a lovely translation. Mara slinks away. So Mara can't deal with being seen. Mara is the unconscious demon that as soon as it's seen, has no power. So you see the doubt. I'm not good enough. Like, oh, look, that's the doubt voice. Hello, doubt. You know. And then your practice is to see it over and over forever. That make sense?
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. Last thing.
I have a question about grasping. It seems like... Let me assemble my thoughts.
Yeah.
This is something I struggle with a lot in my pursuit of liberation from suffering. Is that it seems that want and desire and grasping very much is associated to me with survival and staying alive.
Yeah.
And not dying.
Truly.
And so there's this, once you surrender or let go or stop wanting, then you're almost passive to your own survival and kind of...
Yeah, so that doesn't quite work, does it?
Yeah, and so to me it's like, what's the goal here?
Yeah.
In some way I'm like, okay, like I want to relieve myself in suffering, but the other thing is like, no, I want to live.
All right.
I want to live.
All right, totally. As long as you want to live, you'll keep living. You might die and get reborn. But, you know, classically speaking, the desire to live is a form of grasping.
Mm-hmm.
That keeps us living, essentially. It keeps us being born in bodies, if you accept that model.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually no problem, right? When grasping is spoken of, we can get really precise and say that it's primarily talked about in relation to grasping the objects of the senses. So, like, survival is more of an abstraction than like liking an image or liking a sound or liking a taste. It's like liking existence itself in a certain way. And so it's a very subtle form of grasping, and the sense is that that too falls away, but only at the very, very, very end of the path. Right? And we can... pull out this word that the Buddha said, the thing that he was searching for was the deathless. So actually freedom from the round of birth and death at all, which is going to mean letting go of the wish to continue living.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the paradox and part of the thing that is impossible to explain about the liberated state
mm-hmm.
is that it actually is it's possible to be in an alive state having let go of the desire to continue living, but not in a way that gives rise to like passivity or nihilism or
mm-hmm.
or what we think that's going to be like. It's one of those things that like, I think I can't let that go. It's so important. Actually, you can totally perform the necessary tasks of maintaining bodily well-being and have a heart that's completely at peace around life and death.
Maybe it's more that you're in acceptance of the outcome either way, that you're still pursuing.
Yes.
So, for example, like,
yeah.
I don't want to just sit still in my life and meditate. I want to go pursue things and grasp for things and search for higher heights and bigger, better me's.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to do that, but I still am going to get sick and old and die. So.
Yes. Right, so are you okay with the whole process, we could say? Like, you're going to search and do things and have adventures and hopefully, like, contribute to the world in an amazing way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the teaching that shows up also in the Hindu Talmud, like in the Gita. Your instruction is to be cool with either success or failure. Right? Death is inevitable. Some things will succeed, some things will fail. Some things will lead to pleasures, some things will lead to pains. Actually letting go of that grasping onto life is the same, in a way, of letting go of the grasping onto success in a venture,
mm-hmm.
right? I might still do it.
Mm-hmm.
And based in conditions and karma and all sorts of
mm-hmm.
how things unfold, it's going to turn out however it turns out, right? And so then part of the practice is do it, letting go of the result.
Okay.
And that's okay. Whatever happens must be okay because it's what happens. And we can either contract around what's happening or not.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And the contraction is what causes the suffering.
The contraction is the suffering. And that's all that the suffering is in this tradition. So it doesn't actually tell us what to do or not do. It's not a quietist tradition. It suggests that if you want to be quiet, it's possible to get very, very quiet and extremely blissful in meditation. But that's not the only way. And actually, you could have as many adventures as you like. But the hinge of suffering is specifically in that grasping. In how, it's basically, it's not what we do, but how we do it. Right? It's a good question. All right, so it's a pleasure. It's 9:19. We did pretty well on time. And it's great to bat this around with you. We'll continue from here. As we go on through the summer, I will periodically keep bringing in the page of chants and some of the orientation toward the kind of formal early Buddhist teachings. We'll keep touching back into that. As always, we're fully operating on the gift economy here. So the gift of your resources supports the studio and myself to offer essentially an anti-capitalist situation. And that's a rarity in this culture. It goes against the stream. So thank you for your generosity in relation to making that happen. Donations go in the basket. And I will see you next week. Take very good care.